Good morning. Education policy could be changing at the federal level. Still, under the Every Student Succeeds Act, states have more control. Today, we'll talk with Sarah Shelton of the Education Commission of the States. It's a nonprofit that compares policies across the nation and which made a presentation to Hawaii's legislature. Policies of all types are under scrutiny by a group that was once full of Hawaii supporters of Bernie Sanders. Now, they're the young progressives demanding action. One of them, Cameron Sato, joins us later today. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Scarlet Crow is a Maui duo that wants to build a bridge to mystical consciousness through its music. And Roscoe Wusterwald and his cohorts in Onward, Etc. are a traveling band, one whose ramblings change each show in each new town. They're going to be with us in our studio.
It's Thursday, January 26th. That's The Conversation right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
We've kind of got a whole new political class in America sprung up over the last couple of years, young progressives.
This is true. And how they have been springing up largely came through the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Exactly.
We saw a lot of that happening. But what happens with all the energy, you know, when it has to go somewhere? Where is it going now? We're going to talk about that this morning. Because, you know, with all the recent calls for civic engagement, it could sound like the rhetoric we usually hear around legislative sessions and election campaigns. But in a political climate with President Trump seeking to control the thermostat, the calls to action for Democrats are already more than just pat phrases, perhaps especially to former Bernie Sanders supporters. In Hawaii, that would include Cameron Sato, once a member of Students for Bernie. Cameron Sato is now a legislative aide for Senator Stanley Chang and an active member of the group the Students for Bernie became, the young progressives demanding action. So what exactly do they want? Cameron Sato is in our studio with a little bit of a slice of information about that. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Beth Ann. It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you to all the listeners out there.
So when you look at how this group transcended from being directly involved with the Bernie Sanders campaign to many of those issues that were brought up through the campaign, how expressly do you see them being evident in Hawaii?
So we all understand that nationally we have President-elect Trump, we have a Republican-controlled House and Senate, and that if we want to see progressive change happen here in Hawaii, it has to be done by us locally. So when Bernie Sanders spoke about the minimum wage or marijuana legalization or addressing income inequality, these issues can be addressed here locally by us.
We've been told now for quite a while that at what happens in your local level is what you feel most.
Absolutely.
That's the impact that most people are going to train their attention toward. And when you bring up some of these issues that all surround, you know, social justice or environmental justice or many of the things that we put before the word justice now, what are you seeing in the legislature this time around that young progressives are being able to take on as their work this time?
Well, let's take minimum wage, for example. There are more than at least five bills I'm looking at right now that are addressing this issue, that are taking this seriously. So I can see there must be some sort of support from the public if that many legislators really want to address this issue.
Then again, you've got a lot of people who are involved in business who, you know, through the Chamber of Commerce, have said in a steadfast way for several years that they can't afford it. If that minimum wage rises, that they're going to have to put more people into part-time situations or and cut back in other ways.
So what the they've done many, many studies about this topic. And what they all say is when you increase the minimum wage at a gradual level, when you incrementally increase it, not a rapid increase, when we approach $15 by 2021 or 2023, that allows the economy to adjust. And that when we compare two counties across state lines that have different minimum wages, we see no increase in unemployment.
Looking at the years that it will take to get to that $15, also looking at how the real amount of money that you make and what that translates into buying power is also changing. There are those who are saying this is nice, but it's too slow and it's not going to necessarily result in the kind of change that you're talking about.
Absolutely. You know, lots of people want to see a minimum wage now. That right now, people need a minimum wage of about $14.60 or so is what some of the data suggests. Is to live in Hawaii, you need about $14.60. But for years and years, people like the Chamber of Commerce have said that we're going to have massive unemployment. So we've been sheepish about increasing the minimum wage up until around a couple of years ago where we first started increasing it. When before that, we had not increased it for 7 years. So what we're doing right now is we're trying to catch up with the increased cost of living that we have not been able to catch up with in the previous many years. But now that there is this strong grassroots support, we hope to have some support this legislative session and get this thing passed.
Minimum wage has already been increasing. How do you see what we have already been on track to do now dovetailing with some of the bills that you see there that might accelerate it?
So, I guess the other things that people want to talk about are the oxybenzone ban, as well as having the PUC realigned to...
I'm talking about the minimum wage in terms of that, because, you know, we've been watching it increase steadily.
Yes.
And that seems to be, you know, the big nugget that everyone has been surrounding to talk about it within, you know, living wage. We've talked about that for a very long time. And as that's one of the major issues that you've taken on with the Young Progressives, how do you see this dovetailing with the trajectory that we're already on now as we've been slowly increasing it?
Oh, okay. Yes, that would put us on track to approaching a minimum wage that would allow people to have a decent life where they aren't working 2 40-hour-a-week jobs just to get by, because the rent and the cost of living in Hawaii is very high. And when people, what people are going to tell me now is they're going to tell me, oh, well, now, Cameron, you're going to make the cost of everything go up. But the study suggests that when you do have an increase in minimum wage, that the cost of goods and services do not increase at the same rate as minimum wage.
In the interest of time, we're going to move on to that other
yes.
bill that you were talking about, the oxybenzone bill. You're also taking on environmental justice.
Yes. So there's a lot of things that people are concerned about, from AES to Red Hill. But specific legislation that we have this session is oxybenzone, as well as having the PUC look at how ratepayers are how Hawaiian Electric is compensated for rates. So SB 366 will allow the PUC to set up an incentives-based system based on performance, and as opposed to just pumping out more electricity and building projects. So this would realign to allow for a more sustainable Hawaiian Electric and a more sustainable grid, and allow people to have rooftop PV in this overall ecosystem.
You're moving in lots of directions with the Young Progressives.
Yes.
But if you had to look back over your shoulder, say, after the session is finished, is there part of the platform, if you will, of the Young Progressives that you would say would be fulfilled by a certain part of it? If you had to choose from among all those things that you're out there actively trying to promote, what would give you the most satisfaction by the end of the session?
So picking one of the several issues is challenging, but...
probably not going to get them all.
Well,
right?
we have... It's not just myself leading it. We have several other people who are going to be engaged in following each sort of these constituency groups we have broken out. We have people who are going to be pushing for the emergency pregnancy centers or pregnancy clinics, the so-called fake abortion clinics, to... inform the public that when they are doing business, that they need to provide information that they are not providing healthcare services, they are not certified healthcare services, and or that we need to address the inequity or the inhumanity of conversion therapy, that we need to ban conversion therapy, that there are many, many peoples across this nation who are very traumatized, and the suicide rates or the suicide from as a result of conversion therapy is just unacceptable.
Conversion therapy meaning the idea that you can change someone's sexual orientation.
Absolutely, Beth Ann.
Okay, so with all of those things and so many people working on so many levels, as a group, though, of young progressives that you've coalesced, you don't have just a bunch of independent people working around together, but is there something that you think is the absolute must for this session?
I guess because I'm tasked with economic issues, I am impartial to the minimum wage, but my other partners care greatly about the environment and as well as social justice. So for me, it's minimum wage, but for others, they would say otherwise.
Well, it's nice to see all of you engaged, and we'll see which one of you is right.
Yes.
Come the end of the session, what happens. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much.
Cameron Sato started organizing with the Bernie Sanders campaign while studying mechanical engineering at UH Manoa. He's now involved with the Young Progressives Demanding Action, and he is working for Senator Stanley Chang. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, the music and mysticism of Scarlet Crow. But first, your backyard quiz.
Later in the show, we'll be discussing education policy with representatives of the Education Commission of the state. That got us to thinking about the history of public education in Hawaii. It was first established here by King Kamehameha III. In addition to being the first in Hawaii, it was also the first public education system west of the Mississippi. Also, the first education system to use Hawaiian as the primary language of instruction. Kamehameha shepherded many revolutionary changes to Hawaiian society, one of them being the creation of the kingdom's first fully written constitution, which officially created a constitutional monarchy in Hawaii. For today's quiz, we'd like to know what year that was of the first constitution. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer, and we may declare you the winner of today's prize.
Aloha, I'm Ro Rivas from Hawaii Sacred Choir. You're tuned to HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Learn more about what you hear on the show on facebook.com/HIConversation.
Maria Stark and Carmen Crow are a performing duo with a mission to connect audiences to forces within themselves. They call themselves Scarlet Crow and sing what they call enchanting songs of mystic folklore and urban Avalon-inspired prose. They're performing tonight on Maui, and Maria is on the line from there. Good morning.
Hi, Chris.
Good to talk to you. All right. You've certainly got your own approach to music, the two of you, and I wondered how it all came together.
Oh, well, Carmen and I have been playing music together in the same sort of circle of songwriters for many years, probably 7 years now.
Uh-huh.
And 2 years ago, we decided that we wanted to do a tour together, just to support each other, learn each other's songs. And what emerged from that as we started talking about the tour and dreaming about it is that a whole council of women came together and we started really asking, you know, why would we want to do this and how could our community benefit? And from there, it just, this project emerged and these opportunities to have really much deeper conversations with our audience and our community started happening, and it's just kind of taken off on with a life of its own.
What's a kind of an example of a deeper conversation? Where do you like to be able to go with an audience?
Well, one of the original conversations we were both having is that we were kind of living in a community that's really into the new age goddess culture, like mm-hmm. the goddess rising on the planet.
Sure.
And both Carmen and I, for whatever reason, sort of were having an allergy on some level to that, those words, goddess.
I hear you. Yeah.
Sacred yeah. feminine. But we also were in deep respect and reverence for balancing the feminine. And so that was one conversation we were having with groups of people, you know, what is it like to be immersed in sort of this language of goddess emergent culture? How is that working? What's the benefit of that? Where is it still sort of thin? How are the men in response to that? You know, kind of just peeking under the curtain a little bit because,
well, clearly, Maria, some things about that trouble you. What kind of things?
Well, I was just, my own feeling was I was wanting more. I was wanting to understand. I was having conversations with my brother and the men in my life that were wanting to be supportive of women and coming into their power. And you know, especially with the Women's March, there's so much energy for the rise of the feminine voice. But a lot of the men that I were talking to were still feeling maybe disconnected in a way where they still have their own process and wounding, or maybe they were encountering women that were not able to reach into their heart with what they were needed. And there was just sort of like, I don't know, there was like a communication barrier that was
as if it were
so active.
As if it were kind of an almost an isolationist movement, in a sense.
Yeah, well, I was I studied a little bit the feminist movement. You know, it's a very important movement in the 60s and 70s. And then really curious about the backlash. You know, what changed from that, and where has there been sort of a pushing away of that relationship? And where is there still bridges to be built in the relationship between men and women inside of this greater conversation of balance?
All of that gives your music a great deal of weight for its. You're really looking for your songs to be about something. And Maria, I want to play just a quick sample of one of your tunes just to ask you about it. It's called Unstoppable Joy. Let's just hear a few seconds of that.
Sure.
Well, that's a pretty clear message, isn't it, Maria?
That song, yeah. I think the core of, I think the, one of the reasons I make music, my history is in, or my background is in music therapy.
Uh-huh.
And so really using music to build a bridge of relation between people, and at the center of that work is really how do we access our innate joyful nature even if we're processing a lot of really intense things going on in the world, that there is a power of our, like, I think that, like, we all have a core that is capable of so much beauty and pleasure and joy, and I think that that has an unstoppable quality to really raise the spirits of the planet.
And music is a pretty good way to get to it, isn't it, Maria?
I think so. You know, I think it accesses this part of our subconscious, and it relates to our cognitive capacity in a way where it almost, it has a magic to it. It's just like it connects us to our body, it connects us to our rhythm, it connects us to our heartbeat, it connects us to things that are unseen, and it's a mood changer, and it creates all of these endorphins in our brain. Music is a magical wielding thing, and it's so pure. You know, it comes from this pure, right. I think, like, we innately as musical beings have this drive, and that when we are immersed in music, we can't help but respond in a way. And so I think it's an incredibly powerful vehicle for sharing and growing and building community. And
it kind of gets by all the barriers our minds put up to keep things like that out, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, yeah, let's hear a real quick fragment. Let's hear a real quick fragment of a song called Crossroads.
You leave this road behind you, far enough, no one catches your trail.
Now that sounded to me more personal, Mario. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, that song Crossroads is deeply personal. It was sort of the biggest harvest that I took away from the ending of a relationship that really meant a lot to me. And yeah, it was like that was the final kind of song that came from that experience.
Interesting use of the word harvest as something to be gotten out of just about any kind of experience. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that, you know, and that's another reason I like music, because I think that if I write a song about an experience, I can sort of wrap it up in a piece of poetry, and then I can see it outside of myself rather than being so, like, inside of it.
Makes sense.
And it helps. Yeah.
Well, Maria, thanks very much for talking with us, and I appreciate getting to hear a little bit of your music. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me on the show, Chris.
Sure. Maria Stark and Carmen Crow are a performing duo called Scarlet Crow. They'll be performing tonight at the Temple of Peace in Haiku, Maui.
America closes its doors.
We've defended other nations' borders while refusing to defend our own.
The wall is closer to reality, and the tired, poor, and huddled masses once welcomed are told there's no room for you here. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
As you may remember, Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard wasn't at the Trump inauguration last week. She was somewhere else, Syria. Now we know the secret trip included a meeting with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has a reality check.
Yes, although, Beth-Ann, we don't know too much more about the trip, but Tulsi Gabbard did, in fact, meet with President Assad. No details about what they had to say, but she did say that the opportunity presented itself. She hadn't planned to meet with him, but in fact did. As we all know, Assad has been charged with a number of things: human rights violations, abuse, murdering dissidents, and of course the state of Syria right now is an absolute civil war and a humanitarian crisis with all the refugees.
Which is why she said in the interview that was on CNN and others that, you know, that she was going to Syria to be able to see the Syrian people firsthand and right. to understand what was happening there. But the secrecy that surrounded this trip and the fact that she did, in fact, meet with President Assad has got a lot of people seemingly rankled over this and very confused as to why this would be something that she would do unilaterally.
Right. And I think there will be some more information. Her office is saying that they, as any congressperson has to do, they got to report details of their trips coming for them. At least one other media source is saying that it was an Arab American community center in Ohio that paid for the event, paid for the trip. We don't know much more about that. But we can tell you that Tulsi Gabbard has definitely opposed intervention on behalf of the rebels, specifically U.S. intervention. She's sponsoring a bill to not have the U.S. Give money to these groups that are trying to overthrow Assad. But remember, Barack Obama wanted Assad to step down. He famously drew the line in the sand about the poison weapons and, of course, didn't follow through with that. Remember as well that Gabbard met with Donald Trump early on after the election to caution him, to try and get him to not side with the defense hawks, if you will, and to stay out of Syria. She's strongly opposed to what she calls counterproductive regime change wars.
But again, going through all of that and why she did this unilaterally seems to be the real question.
I think so. Our Kirsten Downey in D.C., she did talk to Conlene Hanabusa, Gabbard's Democratic colleague from Hawaii, who said it was an unusual trip. One wonders whether the U.S. position might change towards Syria under a Trump administration, and we'll see whether that's favorable. But she has gotten a lot of attention, not just CNN. Tulsi Gabbard, as we know, has an ability to get a lot of attention, period, in a number of different forms. But this is a truly unusual situation. To meet with someone who's accused of being a mass murderer is remarkable.
But your point about the attention again goes back to the question about, is that why she did this unilaterally? Well, I guess we're going to have to wait and see what further details emerge. But thanks very much for this morning.
You're welcome, Beth.
We'll talk to you tomorrow. Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat. Education policy may be changing in Washington, but how much of that will impact states may be less of a question under the Every Student Succeeds Act, the successor to No Child Left Behind. But as states have more control over their education systems, how do they do it? Well, that's the basic question. And states are getting some answers from a nonprofit that shares state education policy information and opportunities to trade best practices for a changing world. The Education Commission of the States is visiting Hawaii this week for a presentation to Hawaii lawmakers. Sarah Shelton is part of the state relations team, and she joins us in our studio now. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to be here.
For a lot of educators, parents, students, trying to look at the world through this changing lens of innovation is something that has been difficult to be able to do. How do you prepare a child for a job that we don't yet know may exist in a world that's changing so quickly that we don't really have a blueprint for it, and yet we have a blueprint for education in Hawaii? How do you reconcile those things with some of what education can do to be able to create that flexibility and that ability to see change and react and creatively problem solve?
Sure, that's a great question. And before I answer that, I just want to give you a little background, your listeners, about Education Commission of the States. So as Beth Ann mentioned, we serve as partners to state policymakers. We provide personalized supports, unbiased information, and opportunities for collaboration. And we do this because we believe in this power of learning from experience, and we know that informed policymakers create education policy. As we have looked at the elections of 2016, as you know, there's been a lot of changes in the state leadership landscape, new governors on the rise, a number of new legislatures, 17% of state legislators in 2017 are new to their position. So the changing landscape of leaders who work on education is significant. So we really work to inform unbiasedly policymakers as they grapple with some of these big questions of how do you educate young kids for jobs that we don't know that are going to exist by the time we graduate. And we really work with states and policies to make sure that they have the right policies in place and they're working together.
Okay, so let's talk about some of those because our time is short and I want to be able to get to some of the substantive issues that you talked about with our lawmakers here in being able to shape where we are now into where some of the blueprints says we ought to go. What states are we learning most from, or what states do you think we have the most to learn from?
Sure. So I think there's a number of states that we can call on. When we talked to the legislature yesterday, we talked about some of the education policy trends that we're seeing in other states and how Hawaii fits into that picture. So we talked about teacher shortages, and certainly there is teacher shortages across the country, and they're more acute in certain areas and in certain schools with certain characteristics. And we know that there's been a lot of task force and working groups going on in certain states who are looking at these shortages. And Arizona has had a task force and a working group. California, Delaware, and Illinois are all doing work in this area. And it looks like providing financial incentives to recruit and retain teachers. It's looking at mentoring induction. It's looking at teacher leadership and then some marketing and outreach to ensure that teachers are coming to fill the slots that need to be filled in certain schools.
But Sarah, many of those things that you just mentioned, in fact, you know, all of them are things that, you know, we have already talked about and that we think that we've, you know, brought into this in a way that would greatly enhance the chances of being able to have a teacher workforce that not only loves what it does, but also gets paid better, perhaps, and also feels that it's closest to its students so that it can be more responsive. All that aside, what truly do you see that is a difference that Hawaii should be making in maybe some of those areas or in the way in which it's allowed to bring in innovation to keep those teachers and educators closest to their communities and their kids?
Sure. Well, I know there's a lot of conversations going on in the state around this issue. It's a priority. And I think making sure that there's the right policies in place and that there's opportunities for school leaders and schools also to be empowered to make some of these decisions around staffing and recruiting the right people and growing your own teachers in Hawaii. I know that that's an area in which there's conversations of wanting to explore that a little bit more of creating a pipeline of young students in Hawaii who actually stay and become educators in the state in the schools where you need them most.
What states have something to give to Hawaii, and what do you think that Hawaii has to present to other states?
Well, I think Hawaii has a lot to present to other states. I think the gains that Hawaii has made on the NAEP scores have been significant, and that's important. I think
I think you should define NAEP scores.
Sure. So NAEP is the National Assessment of Educational Progress, and it's the largest nationally representative assessment of what students need to know across the states. So making gains in that is significant when other states, their levels on the NAEP scores around science, math, and reading stayed relatively flat. Hawaii has also had a decrease in chronic absenteeism, which is important. And I think it signals that Hawaii students are really showing up to school in a safe, supportive environment. And then Hawaii certainly has made progress around college and career readiness, around advanced placement, around dual credit, which has been significant in Hawaii. I know it started at a grassroots level, and then the state has really latched onto that, wanting
and
to
when you
expand
talk about
programs.
Dual credit, you're talking about someone who could be in high school and get credit for college.
Absolutely. They can get high school and college credit. Thank you. And then increases in college enrollment in Hawaii. So I think there's a lot of bright spots. And it's one thing that we do have the luxury of doing in our organization is highlighting the successes in other states. So that policymakers aren't always reinventing the wheel, that they can understand what other states are doing and perhaps use that to think about things a little bit differently in their state.
Especially with the chafing around Common Core, and many states are feeling that. What states do you see that might be models for Hawaii in certain areas, some of which you may have mentioned, that might move us away from some of that angst and again, be able to show that in moving closer to students, in being able to have more autonomy, despite the fact that we have, you know, a centralized school system, that you may, in fact, get better outcomes?
Sure. So I think ESSA, the Every Student Succeed Act, really gives states the opportunity to create a vision in their state and what they want education to look like and use that to drive their ESSA work. So I think we're going to see with state plans of states thinking a little bit differently about innovation and some of these areas like teacher shortages, dual credit, achievement gap, and what they want to do to move the needle. So I think it will be exciting to see what some of those state plans look like and exciting to see the leaders in these states really start to implement and move that work forward.
Our state is an island state. We have very different you know, island to island, the feel and the characteristics are different. But we also have a cultural component that other states do not have. But they may have other cultural components that may be similar in nature in the way they're brought into a school system. Is there something that you see in Hawaii that you would find as a model for other states or other states that are also doing it in a way that we could do better?
Sure. You know, I think the around the dual credit that you guys have really seen that as an opportunity to provide a continuum for young people and encourage young people to get high school credit and college credit. And you've seen that the enrollment rates in college have increased. So I think that's an important aspect of it. I know that the culture of peace in Hawaii has been very important for you of and an opportunity to continue to narrow that achievement gap and making sure that there's policies in place and supports in place to support all young people.
And so, and especially in charter schools.
In charter schools as well. Yeah, I know that you guys have a robust charter school system.
At this point, when you are dealing with so many states, they're all asking the same questions. It seems that there's more of an agreement that there's more that we don't know that we do, but that there is a flexibility to be able to answer your own questions in your own state, and that everybody is sort of, you know, struggling through it together. Is there anything that you can see happening in Washington now under a Trump administration that might in some ways either augment that ability to do more in each state or possibly thwart it, given the fact that we don't know yet who the Secretary of Education is going to be?
Sure. Great question. You know, I think we're taking a wait and see, wanting to see who the Secretary of Education will be. And, you know, there's certainly, I think, a number of states who have an interest in expanding school choice. So we see that across the states. That states will probably continue to do that. But I think we're really taking a wait and see what will happen at
you
the federal level.
You and everybody else.
Yes, you're right.
Okay. Thanks very much for joining us. Sarah Shelton is a member of the State Relations Team of the Education Commission of the States. It provided an informational briefing on education policy to Hawaii lawmakers this week.
Support for today's programming comes from Maui Arts and Cultural Center, presenting Chad Takatsugi and Friends Sharing Mele from the Past and Present, 7:30 p.m. this Sunday at the McCoy Studio Theater, mauiarts.org.
3 years ago, Google hired 14% of its team members who didn't have a BA degree. Why? Because in the current innovation era, it's about what you can do with what you know and how creatively you solve problems. Later today on Town Square, we talk with expert-in-residence at Harvard's Innovation Lab and all-around education disruptor, Tony Wagner, co-author of Most Likely to Succeed. That's later today at 5 on Town Square. In today's Backyard Quiz, we asked you to tell us the year that Hawaii's first constitution was enacted. It came to be as a result of a Declaration of Rights issued by King Kamehameha III. Up until that point, laws and rights in the Kingdom of Hawaii were derived from a mishmash of the kapu system, rules imposed by Christian missionaries and decrees made by alii families and the monarchy. Traditional punishments such as exile were often implemented unevenly or inhumanely across the islands. Seeking to bring Hawaii into the modern era, Kamehameha III decided to bring all of Hawaii under the control of a European-style legal framework that incorporated Christian values. In 1839, he issued a Declaration of Rights, which was modeled on the American Declaration of Independence, establishing equality for all. A year later, that declaration was incorporated into a full constitution, which formally established a government by constitutional monarchy with sovereignty over the Hawaiian Islands. So 1840 was the year we were looking for. That's today's answer.
And Beth Ann Catherine Perkle of Manoa knew that. So congratulations, Catherine. That's today's quiz. And if you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2017 Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations are February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Roscoe Osterwald is the kind of traveling musician the world used to be full of. He goes from town to town and lets each new location change the nature of his music, his fellow musicians, and his performances. It's a life of constant motion, and with it, constant change. It's brought him to town for a couple of Oahu dates and to our studio this morning. Good morning, Roscoe.
Good morning.
Obviously, this is the life you chose, but why?
Oh, man. I guess at the time I didn't really want to go to college, and I was playing guitar, and I just loved playing in front of people, and at that time I didn't really know what I was doing with my life, and next thing I knew I just got in a van with a group of people, and we designed a tour and hit the road and just kind of lived off of cheap food and cheap liquor. And
slept in the van every now and then?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Pretty much every night we would all just cuddle up in the van.
Well, you know, I've heard it said that it used to be a lot more common and a lot easier to lead that kind of life, but like, how do you design a tour, for example?
Well, to begin with, I was in Alaska, and I was living in a tent, and I would just go to the library every day, and I went and picked out just a handful of cities to route a tour. And I would send out probably like anywhere from like 150 emails a day to different venues in every city, and 149 would say no, but uh-huh. There was just that one that'd be like, yeah, sure, come on in. We don't know what you sound like or what you're doing, but we'll take it. Let's go.
So there's that kind of sense of adventure out there on the other end as well, it sounds
like. Luckily now, we've got a booking agent. Eva from Fata Booking does all our shows now, and she's awesome. She works really hard for us. So
it's more organized than it was when you started
Insanely
out.
Insanely more organized. Yeah.
But still a life, as I said before, of constantly on the move. So you've got to really adapt your whole state of mind to that, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. It's not I mean, a lot of people think of like being a musician is quite the glorious life, but there's a lot of, you know, hardship. It's not an easy life by any means. There's aging, I think, happens a lot quicker as a musician.
Yeah, I couldn't disagree with that too much.
Right.
You know what? You brought a song in. Well, you brought your guitar and with it any number of songs. But let's play one of your original tunes.
All right, cool. This is a new one. I actually picked this one out today because it's about getting lost at sea.
All right.
And we're surrounded by that. So let's do it.
We are.
This one's called The Sons of Neptune.
Out in the ocean, my ship has sunk a mile away. As I float along, I find the stars above shine like your eyes, and they'll help me on my way. As I drifted further from my vessel, helm was swallowed by the waves. Well, I slipped a note into a bottle with a hope that it'd find you well someday. Oh, Caroline, I'm not coming home this time. Caroline, know that I'll be fine in my body, lie somewhere underneath. I'm so sorry that I left you for the sea. guide my body underwater to feed upon what's left. Oh, Caroline, I'm not coming home this time. Caroline, I just know that I'll be fine in my body lies somewhere underneath. I'm so sorry that I left you for the sea. I'm so sorry that I left you for the sea. So I call the ocean floor my home now. My soul belongs to Davy Jones. And on his throne of bones, he'll sing his shanty songs of how we're lost, but we'll never be alone. Oh, Caroline, I'm not coming home this time. Caroline, I just know that I'll be fine. My body lies somewhere underneath. I'm so sorry that I left you for the sea. I'm so sorry that I left you for the sea. I'm so sorry that I left you for the sea. Yeah. I'm so sorry that I left you for the sea.
Thanks, Roscoe.
Yeah.
How many songs you got in your bag, you
think? Oh, in the catalog, man. If
dozens.
I had to guess, up in the hundreds.
Really?
Yeah.
So it must come pretty easily to you to write them then.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of half songs written, I would say.
Sure.
But yeah, it's a constant thing.
Do you keep them together in a journal or a notebook?
As much as I can. I would say there's a lot that I've lost just like through losing a journal or losing a notebook or losing a recording that I had of a song. But
you don't let ideas slip by, it sounds like.
Yeah, definitely. I try to keep the brain churning as much as possible.
Is the life a help to that? You know, the fact that you sort of – it's march or die, you know, sharks got to swim kind of thing?
Yeah, definitely. I think the first two records that I wrote were more of – like an outer reflection on the observations that I had, like about other people's situations and things that I just observed while roaming this planet.
Mm-hmm.
But this new album that's we're pretty much going in studio right when we get back from here is more of like a self-reflection. And that's been probably the hardest thing that I've ever written, is trying to turn the writing, like looking in a mirror and writing more about myself and my situations in life. And so that's been an interesting kind of like curveball in the writing.
You know, that came process. Up in a conversation we had with a songwriter in the first half of the show, where it actually can be give you some insight into yourself by writing a song about
Definitely.
Yourself.
I think I've learned a lot about myself and the way that I've lived just by trying really hard to like think about my life in a writing sense.
Roscoe, thanks a lot for coming in.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for
having
me.
Pleasure to hear you. Sounded really good.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Roscoe Wisterwald plays guitar and sings lead vocals in Onward, Etc., a three-piece band based currently out of Bend, Oregon, plays what it calls Americana Rowdy Folk, performed tomorrow night at Downbeat Lounge in Honolulu and Saturday at Wailu Surf Shop.
on January 28th in the Atherton Studio. It's an evening of music from the Rainbow Road and the North Shore, when violinist Nancy Shoup Woo and classical slack key guitarist Ian O'Sullivan perform music from their recent CDs. More at hprtickets.org or call 955-8821 during business hours. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of WBUR's and NPR's On Point, and I'm thrilled that Hawaii will soon be joining our lively national conversation. Tune into On Point on HPR 1 Mondays through Thursdays at 2 p.m. starting February 14th. We look forward to hearing from you, and again, you'll hear us on HPR 1 soon, the news and talk stream for your On Point Hawaii Public Radio.
Chris, you talked to two different musicians today who had very, very personal impacts in their music that we got to hear.
And really talked of the ways that they gained from writing songs of a really that had a self-examination component.
Well, tomorrow we're going to hear something a little different. We're going to check in with Maud Cumming. She's the chair of Bridging the Gap, to find out how the volunteers are managing during Hawaii's homeless count this week, the point in time count.
And we'll look ahead to Maui's Common Ground Dance Festival.
You can always get to us at hawaiipublicradio.org and send us your comments and your questions.
That's right. And you can hear past shows under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you in the morning with The Conversation.